Welcome back to Prison Breaking, everyone. I'm Paul.
And I'm Sarah. We're grateful, as always, to have you with us.
So this was a big episode. We just watched it, rewatched it together. We just had a rewatch party together. Ooh. And there's a lot going on. There's some narrow escapes. There's some comeuppances. There's some getting it on.
There's a new word that I had to look up.
Wait, what? You had to work? You had to look up a word? Oh, yes. Right.
Yeah. Remember, yes. Derogated.
Derogated.
Derogated. Michael's psychiatrist says it in our scene. And I actually, I'm such a nerd. I went back to my script and I was like, did I do my good actor thing and look up this word? And I did not. I had not written it down in the margin, which...
Maybe Sarah doesn't know the word.
Maybe not. Or maybe old Sarah, younger Sarah knew the word. Do you want to guess what it means? You don't have to.
Derogated, like it's like derogatory, like reduced, criticized, limited.
Dude, yes, entirely. Okay. Yes, entirely. According to Merriam-Webster, derogate means to cause to seem inferior, semicolon, to disparage. Okay.
All right. I'm very excited to talk about this episode, but first, should we do the index?
We shall do the index.
Let's do it.
Paul, you want to give people the Calestine Index?
The Calestine Index,
go!
My friend. This episode of Prison Break Season 1 was titled Tweener, and it aired on Halloween, October 31st, 2005. Paul Schuring, Prison Break creator, wrote it. He wrote the pilot, of course, also. And it was directed by Matt Earl Beasley.
Okay, our recap. The guard room repair job is taken from Michael, threatening his plan. Mm. Sarah talks to Michael's psychiatrist. that's a reference to the Animaniacs for anyone in our generation. Sarah talks to Michael's psychiatrist and realizes that he suffers from low latent inhibition, making him both sympathetic and a genius.
Wow.
And irresistible to women. Bellick tells Abruzzi that the mob hasn't paid for his protection this month, and Abruzzi's position may be given to Fiorello, whose name I'm learning for the first time, Fiorello. Yep. So Abruzzi gouges out Fiorello's eye, as you do.
Oof.
Meanwhile, Donovan and Saverin learn...
That is Monica, that is Veronica Donovan and Nick Saverin.
True story. They learn from the wife of the VP's brother that his commercial partners could be the ones behind his death.
All right. For some numbers, 9.01 million viewers tuned in. We were let in by last week's episode, as we have been throughout this first season. That was The Old Head. And we were up against something different on NBC this time, a rerun of Medium, as well as the usual 2.5 men on CBS, the NFL, on ABC, where the Steelers beat the Ravens 20-19.
In pop culture news, a few days before this episode dropped on October 28th, the final episode of Everybody Loves Raymond aired. That ended a huge 9-season run for the show. Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes announced their engagement, while Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt announced their divorce. I guess that was making their tabloid headlines.
There's some kind of circle game quote here, like things go up, things go down.
Time is a flat circle.
Around we go. Yes.
And okay, this one makes me, this I sort of love a whole bunch. In extra random pop culture news, Chuck Norris satirical facts had become, for some unknown reason, maybe we don't need a reason, very popular. For instance,
yes,
Chuck Norris doesn't read books. He stares them down until he gets the information he wants.
Oh, so many good ones.
Chuck Norris never retreats. He just attacks in the opposite direction.
Amazing.
Or lastly, and this is my favorite, Death once had a near Chuck Norris experience. And of course, for those of you who are paying very close attention to the credits, Eric Norris, Chuck Norris's son, was in fact our stunt coordinator from season 2 forward.
Yes, and he was a wonderful guy and a really good stunt coordinator.
Yes.
It seemed like a very Chuck-oriented family. But everybody seemed really cool, right?
Pro-Chuck? Who isn't pro-Chuck?
Yeah. Did Eric live in Dallas? Do you remember? Did he live in Dallas?
Yeah, because I think when Gary Brown brought the show to Dallas, he nabbed most of the crew from Walker, Texas Ranger.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Yeah. Got it.
Dallas, Texas, Norris. It's all making sense. In real news, in news of the world, the New Orleans Superdome, which had been rebuilt in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina weeks before, reopened with a Monday night football game between the Saints and the Atlanta Falcons. Big symbolic step in the recovery of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. The UN released a report that the global population had hit 6.5 billion people and warned about overpopulation and the impact that would have on resources. And President George W. Bush nominated Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court, replacing Sandra Day O'Connor, first female justice on the court after her retirement.
And that cheerful bit of information that had no bearing on women's rights for generations will bring us to the watch party.
So
this is the recap of the watch party. We're going to count it down. It's condensed. Yep. If you want to listen to the whole thing, obviously, you can subscribe and you can listen along with us. Okay. We're going to count down in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
All right.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Trigger warning. I forgot that happened in this episode. That was beautifully done, by the way.
Oof. Brutal.
That work from Wentworth was really beautiful. You know, you're not very nice to Danny.
No, not nice. It was our dynamic.
Yeah. It's our vibe.
That's a rough weapon.
Also, what's that weird light?
Oh, he doesn't kill him, though. Oh, my God, I remember this. Eesh.
That's a shot. Ooh.
Doesn't kill him, just brutalizes him.
There's a code, there's a code, there's a code, there's a code. This is a code family. It's LJ. I'm with Veronica. I'm okay. I'm going to cry a bunch in this episode. Thank you for that rewatch, folks. For being with us, and we will be right back to talk about the episode.
Okay, welcome back, fishes. We have got our notes from the rewatch, some things that we want to touch on and talk about, and we have a few things we wanted to talk about from the last episode with Jessalyn.
Is that right? We didn't get to. Yes.
Oh, some things we didn't get to. Okay.
Yeah, because we had such an amazing conversation with Jessalyn. We didn't actually talk much about the episode.
Copy that.
But I took a bunch of notes on the tweener episode of things that I wanted to talk to you about.
Yeah.
So there was a running shot that we flagged between LJ and Kellerman. Your mom was on set. You said some unspeakable things to Marshall under the car. But, I want to get to all these things.
Yeah.
I kind of want to start with your mom on set. I don't know why, but...
We shot in Chicago. I'm from Chicago, so my family was there. I remember my mom was working still downtown, and I think she came by that day, and it was when I was chasing LJ after the death of his mother and mother's boyfriend. And I remember my mom was there, and she just watched me run for like an hour and a half. And I was like, no, I really actually do some acting too. But then she had to go. So she didn't see then me torturing poor LJ, or I should say Marshall, who was hiding under a car, and I was hunting him in the parking lot.
What did you say to him? You said you said some things to him to get some reaction.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that. I wanted to talk about this actually. I wouldn't call it improvising because sometimes when you're doing or shooting a reaction shot of somebody, you will say things off camera to get a reaction out of them, even if it's kind of, I mean, part of the show, but something that would never necessarily be on the show. Like you would swear, you would use you would be harsher than your character might be. Just to kind of try to elicit a reaction from them. I said, and there was a whole thing about my character teasing LJ that his mother was dead. Oh. And we shot my side of that first. And then Marshall was under the car and they had a camera like on his face. And he's pretty good at getting worked up. He's a good actor in that regard. And he said, you know, you can torture me as much as you want, da 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 da. And I said some really horrible things. Really horrible things. And I always think, well, you know, isn't that the assignment? Didn't you want me to say some horrible things? And then afterwards, people look at you like, you're fucked up, dude. You're fucking weird, dude. And I'm like, well, we're playing. I'm supposed to be upsetting him. I'm going to say things about his dead mother. And then people are like, that's really harsh, man.
Well, especially because often when you're in a situation like that, you've either been given permission by the other actor, or you've been given the ask by the director, but privately. Hey, Paul, do me a favor. Tell Marshall that, you know, his mom, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
The crew doesn't know that. They just know that in the middle of the scene, you start
saying, you've gone off stuff that's not in the script.
Awful.
It's slightly personal and mean and clearly designed to get a reaction. I wanted to tell my running story.
Oh, tell me the running story. I want to hear it.
So I got out of the car to chase LJ. I'd never done that. No, I had done that. I should actually say I had done that before. But not on the street and not when it was like wet. Oftentimes they will spray water all over the street to not to make it look wet, just to make it look darker. Which is dangerous for everybody that's... Yeah, it's just dangerous for people that are sprinting in their wingtips.
Ooh.
But I enjoyed it. I loved that kind of thing. I was like, badass, I'm going to run. It's going to be great. And I ran and I was really fast. And a bunch of the camera guys were like, you're too fast. You're running too fast. And I was like, yeah, like felt so, you know. Then somebody, I don't remember if it was Billy, who was a... I don't know if it was Billy that said it to me or one of the other camera operators. He said, you know, I did a Mel Gibson movie, and when he runs to like make up space for the camera, he doesn't run as fast as he can, but he really pumps his arms and it makes, and you know, they just shoot him from the waist up and it really looks like he's running fast. So I was like, okay. So in the second shot or one of the sets, I'm doing that and it looks really bad.
And did I think not somebody, shoot you from the
I think
up?
Somebody, I think somebody sold me a bill of goods on that.
That's very funny.
Yeah.
I love it. I mean, cameramen, you know, because they're following us with equipment, I think often we get asked to slow down, and every single time it happens, it makes me feel like a stud for just a minute.
Yeah, yeah, right.
You know what I mean, hey, like, could you slow down? We're having trouble following you.
Camera can't even catch up with me. I'm so fast.
I get that a lot. From people carrying 70 pounds of film equipment on their shoulders going backwards.
Right. Yes.
It does look really cool. I will say, like, all of those scenes with you and LJ, they have such a palpable level of threat that gives the rest of the show such real stakes, you know, because you do have this sense that, like, the bad guy really will win.
I remember feeling, and it was fun. It was the first time I'd ever really played a character whose actions every single time altered the trajectory of the story massively.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just realizing it as I say it that way. Like, you know, like, well, why did this feel so impactful? It's like, well, you know, it changes the tone of the show when you kill the kid's parents.
The dramaturgy of your character is never irrelevant. I think it also tells the audience, like, really not many people are safe here.
Yeah. And it also tells the audience, which was great for me as an actor, oh, this person will they're capable of this. And like, that's the goal. Like, they will kill people in their way. And that just, then it makes every scene you're in going forward, like, super tense and powerful. They're putting the bells behind this. But also it's like, oh, he could just pull his gun out and kill somebody.
And, you know, the other thing that's cool about it is they played it, and you and Danny played it, as though that was new for you. And so every time you took a step like that, Danny kind of looked over and went, What the fuck are we doing?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And so we get a sense that, like, this guy is going further and further and further down the evil yes. path.
So it feels like, you know, it's about to slip out of control at any moment, which is great.
Okay, there was something else I wanted to ask you about, getting out of the car with a gun like Mercer.
Oh, I just, these are silly little actor things that I was getting used to. You know, there was a, if this is too insider baseball, I apologize. But, you know, there was a lot of times where Kellerman would just produce a gun in a scene. And I was like, there's no way this guy has this gun on him. Like, there's nowhere to put it. There is a thing I learned when I studied Secret Service, in particular, that first of all, when you look at Secret Service, when they're at work, they never have their jackets buttoned.
No.
And there were actually specific guns made by one of the gun manufacturers, I don't know which, that was contracted by Secret Service. There were these long guns that held flat against your body so that you could put them on under a suit. And it's a whole thing of, obviously, nobody should know who Secret Service, or you can't tell if they're armed and all that stuff. But right. there were a lot of things with Kellerman where it was just like, you know, no jacket, which was fine, and or no overcoat. And it was just like, and then you're over here, and then you're over here, and then you have a gun against the guy. And it was like, wait, where, did we have to have this gun during the scene, or can it just be the magic gun? Mm-hmm. And normally it was just a magic gun. And on the bus thing at Lake, whatever it was, he really wanted the gun out. But there was no way to get out of the car. I mean, it sounds ridiculous to say it out loud now, but there was no way to get out of the car and then take the gun out. Like, it basically, you see me get out of the car, it's like I already have the gun in my hand out. I guess it doesn't.
Like, you've just been riding with it on your lap?
I remember it being weird. But did it look weird to you when you watched it?
You pointed it out.
Yeah, okay.
And my actor brain immediately followed your actor brain to that same place, because like we're theater nerds, and so why of it all matters.
Yeah, like, where's the thing? How'd you put the thing over there? How do you get it? Yeah.
And I feel like for people who come from our background, usually the first 3 years of your career is just a long series of directors going, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And just for me, just when I start to trust that,
and I'll hit your
see
mark.
Something and hit your mark, for the love of God. But then I'll watch something. Usually not something I'm in, because I don't watch much of that. But you watch something and it drives you crazy, because you're like, that's ridiculous. You just pulled a Bible out of your back pocket.
Do you have pet peeves? Do you have acting pet peeves? I have a couple. Not of that I've done. Like, when I see when you see things that you're like, I'll tell you a couple of them. One is there's nothing in that luggage. That is...
Yes.
That luggage weighs nothing, and it's bugging the shit out of me. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Same thing with coffee cups, especially
coffee
the
cups.
Paper cups to go, where you're like, clearly there's no liquid in there, and if there is, it's not hot. And you're not even pretending it's hot, and that's bugging me. But that's just, nobody else notices that, right?
No, that kind of thing drives me crazy. Yeah. And I have more than once asked for... Like, can I please get liquid? For some reason, there was some scene I did on this show where they were like, no, you can't have liquid for some reason. So they like filled it full of sand.
Cool.
And I was like, I appreciate the weight. It is now the heaviest cup of coffee known to man. But sure, like I'll take it as long as there's something in it. Something that drives me nuts is when somebody, quote unquote, drinks from something, but clearly doesn't.
Oh boy.
Like they don't swallow. There's no lipstick on the thingy, or there's an entire plate of food in front of them for an entire scene.
I mean,
and they eat one cherry tomato.
Yeah.
And, you know, I get it. It's hard to the continuity, and you don't want to eat 5 pounds of steak in the course of shooting one scene. But,
I have many stories about that kind of thing.
Okay.
Because I love being a food actor. I love eating food in scenes and stuff. And that actually ends up being, it can be complicated for you. You end up eating a lot of food.
A lot of food.
Yeah. And it has to match. The continuity has to work. It can be a real pain in the ass for everybody. But I found myself in a couple situations where it's scripted.
Like the menu?
Sure. But no, but once on like, once on Private Practice and once on Get Shorty, which is a show that
such a good
I did
movie.
A few episodes.
Wait, it was a show?
Yeah, it was a show with Chris O'Dowd, Davey Holmes made it, and Ray Romano's in. Speaking of Everybody Loves Raymond, it's a really good show. And I played an agent, a Hollywood agent, and there's a scene where it says he eats an entire steak, like during the conversation.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Did you do Barf Bucket?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I didn't.
Yeah, I've never had to do that.
I did Barf Bucket like in my trailer at the end of the day.
Okay.
Like it was like
sometimes people like.
Yeah, you can chew and spit it out, and I pulled the trigger. It was just like it was one of those things where you're like, okay, I just ate 98 ounces of steak. Like I can suffer, I can deal with this for the next 2.5 days, or I can just
the meat sweats.
Meat sweats. I mean, it was literally I was having meat sweats. I didn't know that was a thing, and I was like, what's happening to me? Yeah, they're for real.
I've never really had a situation like this happen to me, but when we shot the last, I think it was the last episode of season one, might have been the one before that, of Walking Dead, there's a scene where we're all in the CDC and everyone's feasting for the first time because there's abundant food. And I was sitting next to Chandler Riggs, as I did the entire first season, right? Like when you play a mom,
that's
your key prop is the kid playing your kid. And I say prop because they often gave him not very much to do in a scene. Uh-huh. And so we would figure stuff out together and we had a lot of fun. But in this scene, there was a pre-wrapped like Little Debbie's brownie. And in the first take, he ate the whole thing. And I was like, you know what? I mean, God love him. He was like 11.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is not, and I think Bernthal was with me on this one. And we're like, hey, bro, you gotta like.
It's gonna go on all day.
We're just super worried about you. And he was like, look me in the eye. There is no amount of brownies that I can't put down. And I was like, okay, bud, well, listen, we're here for you if things change. And like 2 hours later, I looked over at him and he's got like tears in his eyes.
Yeah.
And you know, brutal. I'm a woman. And I was like, John, you gotta go talk to him. You know, like I think he needs a dude right now.
To say like, John, you don't have to do this thing. Yeah.
Or to take him to the bathroom and help him
make
room or whatever. I don't know what happened in there, but John came out and he's like, we can't do this anymore. So I went to our director, who I believe was Guy Ferland. And I was like, he's shorter than the rest of us. Can you be above him?
Oh, smart.
And so they shot the rest of the scene because he was like up to my shoulder. But the poor kid. And I was just like, and I think he had the brownie sweats.
That Kevin Hart show I did, True Story, which is on Netflix, I played his manager, basically. And there was
hilarious in that.
There was a thing that the character had some eating issues and he had gone through Overeaters Anonymous, or he was still working the 12 steps of Overeaters Anonymous. And so we tried to do a thing subtly every
Your
now
character?
And then. Yeah. We tried to do a scene, or we tried to incorporate a thing where when he was stressed out, he would start eating. And there was one big scene between the two of us where the wheels are really fucking coming off. And on stage, it was a hotel set, there was a huge jar. I mean, like I'm making big, huge motions.
This is audio.
Peanut M&Ms, like a lot, thousands.
Like a guess how many are in this jar size jar?
Yeah, yeah. And I started, eating them in rehearsal, and I was like, "They're not right. This is too much. Like they're gonna think it's way too much." And I just kept, and they loved it. They were like, "Oh no, this is great." I ended up eating 5.5 pounds of peanut M&Ms, and they didn't use it.
Thank goodness.
I mean, and I gotta say, it was one of those things where, like, halfway through, I remember saying to Kevin, he loved it, which is the most satisfying. When you can make someone like that, laugh or giddy, and it's his show, So you're like, oh, I'm glad he's liking this. I was kind of like, this is never gonna make it in. And he was like, I love it. Keep doing it.
No, but don't stop.
No, but don't stop.
You're doing a public service.
Yeah.
Speaking of no, but don't stop, My favorite part of this entire episode is Phil Van Leer and Becky.
Oh my goodness.
Like the little, P.S. This is one of my favorite episodes. I'm not entirely sure why, but there's something about it that I think is very cool. There's a lot of different twists and turns, and not only Michael being really clever, but Veronica being clever and LJ being clever, and you know, people. Amaury has like a cool, not Amaury. Sucre has a save, but
it feels a little bit like part. It feels a little bit like. And then Ringo joined, and then we really felt like the band. Like it feels like, and I don't think it's just because Lane joins, although he is great and it's a great character.
Super
but
good.
Like between that
Such
and what's casting. Going on outside the prison, like with Nick and Veronica, what's going on inside the prison? It feels like okay, here's the table has been set. Like it feels like okay, now it's on. I mean, I know it's episode 8 or 9. Like that's a lot of setup, but it does feel like now we see the parameters of what's about to happen clearly. In my opinion, it feels like it hits a certain kind of stride.
It feels like they know what the show really is.
Yeah,
and I'm actually forgive the noise. I'm looking for when we shot this because the old head. My last revised script was from so my blue draft of Tweener.
This is Tweener, right? Yeah Tweener. Mm-hmm.
My last revised script from Tweener was September 13th. So, yeah, I guess we hadn't aired yet. I was wondering, what I'm curious about is when the writer's room starts getting feedback about how the show is doing. Because that must be really interesting. Did that ever happen to you on Imposters, where like you've written 12 episodes, you've shot them, and then now all of a sudden they start airing?
Not in Imposters, it didn't. It happened, obviously.
Private Practice,
or Girlfriend's
right?
Guide, I'm trying to think. Yeah, I mean, the network shows operate more like that. There's more episodes, and it's usually a tighter schedule. When I was running Imposters, we had shot the entire season before it aired, which, you know, whatever the schedule ends up being, you just kind of have to deal with it. We were talking about this the other day. One of the wonderful things about television can be that a showrunner will adjust to what they see in front of them. Yeah.
Well, and I guess maybe at least at this point, this many episodes in, they've had a chance to watch dailies, to watch cuts, and go, hey, the show lives here. One of my other favorite beats is the, this is tied into the Phil and Becky stuff.
You really love the Phil and Becky stuff.
I think, well, partly because it's such a departure from the rest of the show. And it's a little bit of a like, hey, nobody's dying in this moment. These are just, you know, a couple of people living their best lives.
A couple of horny teenagers.
A couple of horny teenagers in their whatever's
50s.
In a prison. But also, so they leave and the cons see them leave. And one of Amaury's very few lines in the episode, there was not a ton of him. Oh. He just goes, do you think he found the hole? I mean, Michael like half turns his head. The whole thing is played in a two shot. They don't cut to, but like it
works. Fucking above the hole. So that is a double entendre.
So well, it just works really, really, really well.
It does. It's a hard thing to pull off too.
And I think they figured out, like, oh, this is a part of the show.
Yeah. I also love that they have this device of the CO and the secretary having an affair, and they just milk it for all the plot turns they can milk it for. Mm-hmm.
Why does nobody figure out that Michael's in the Pope's office? Oh, because they're flirting. Why does nobody find the hole? Because they're having sex.
Because they're fucking, it's so great.
It's a lovely...
Yeah.
But then... Coming back to Amaury, I actually made a little note of like, it starts with just a whole bunch of nasty language coming at Sucre from Bellick.
Oh, yeah.
And that kind of keeps going throughout the show.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a whole lot else to say. And I want to talk to Amaury about how that felt. And also, I wonder how that would be handled today. Like, which is to say, if you are the only Latinx actor on a set, and somebody's job is to throw a bunch of nasty, racially charged language at you. One of the things I know that's happening in Canada right now is, you know, and this is different in some ways, but not all of them, is that like there's a bunch of protocols when we're asking Indigenous actors to perform culturally painful scenes,
oh,
right? Like
really?
Scenes of, yeah. Uh-huh. So there's actually a whole, the Indigenous Film Office has a whole set of protocols about having a trauma-informed elder or counselor on set. Yeah. So that when those actors are done with those scenes, whatever it brings up, they've got somebody to go, hey, could you help me take this out of my spirit and my heart right now? Because it's sitting there like a stone. And let's get it out. Because even though I'm playing a role, it's tied to my real identity.
Sure, sure. Interesting.
And it made me just wonder how, let me put it this way. If I were directing a scene right now where I've got an actor who's receiving a tremendous amount of verbal or physical abuse based on an identity position, I wonder if I wouldn't go to production or if production would suggest, like, can we have somebody on set that day for that person?
Yeah.
Kind of like an intimacy coordinator, but like a trauma processor.
Yes.
There's a better word for that, I'm sure.
But I also think that a good director or producer worth their salt, even before trauma coordinators or whatever you would call it, would make sure that the people participating and even the crew around were comfortable with what was happening. It's just kind of the director's
job. Everybody's comfortable with their boundaries.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just kind of the director's job. I wonder. Something that we were going to talk about, I think last episode, but slightly later, is that we got to go to the World Series of Baseball.
Oh my gosh.
Because these episodes aired during the World Series of Baseball and Fox aired the actual World Series of actual baseball in actual Chicago.
Yeah.
While we were actually shooting.
Yeah. And they got us tickets and they got us really good seats. And it was like you had to wave into the camera. I remember first time I ever had to do that kind of thing.
Like, well, you guys went separately. You went with the guys, right?
I went with my dad.
Oh,
and I ended up sitting near... I have a picture of it somewhere, which is crazy. And by picture, I don't mean a phone picture. I mean, somebody had like a disposable camera. I think it was a Maudy, a couple of friends of his, and then some other people from the show. But there was like a 10 or... I think Nepper, I think it was like 10 of them, and it was pouring rain. It was just a sloppy, gross night. I don't think it was the super long game. But
do you remember what number
game.
It was?
I don't remember what game it was. I know they swept them. So I remember they won the catcher. What was his name? Drove in the winning run. The bottom of the... It might have been 10th. Might have been extra innings. I don't remember. But it was pretty cool to go to a World Series game in Chicago. And not a Sox fan, Cubs fan, but it was still really cool. No, Cubs fan. But, you know, what year was it? Some short 11 years later, we got to go to a Cubs World Series game. Yeah.
And I don't know about you, but we just done the Prison Break season 5. So I ended up getting tickets to that.
No, really?
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Because I was working on Colony and Peter Jacobson was like,
yes,
wait, I need to go to this game. And so I didn't we didn't go together, but I kept calling Todd Adair, who is the wonderful man who hooks up Fox actors with stuff like that. And I was like, Peter Jacobson has to go to this game.
You think we can set a goal for ourselves that we can somehow organically mention Peter Jacobson in every episode of this show?
That should be part of the drinking game. Have a beverage every time somebody mentions Peter Jacobson. He's so lovely. He's also he's so deeply embedded in Chicago athletics.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Chicago everything.
So I went to game 1. And my grandfather, so I was born in Chicago. My parents are both born in Chicago. My grandfather was a refugee.
Michael Reese Hospital, I believe.
Michael Reese Hospital, which has since been demolished. Yeah. So my grandfather moved to Chicago with his with his boss at the time from New York when he was a young man. And his boss at the time was Al Capone. That's a story for another time. But he was a White Sox fan. And White Sox fans had a super long wait.
Yes.
Between World Series appearances. I think it was, what, 19? We talked about this in the last index. But it was super, super long. And so I got to go to game one because I had to go to LA for some press. It was the only one I was available with. And I ended up going with Johnny Messner and Shai McBride, who were on another Fox show together. And I don't even know Shai's real name, but everybody calls him Shai because he's from Chicago.
Is that really why?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Because they call Chicago Chi-Town.
And they do.
Let me tell you, we had so much fun at the game. We went to Gibson's beforehand and had ourselves, you know, steak and martini.
Big old steak, yeah.
Big old steak. Not quite 96 ounces, but we did have ourselves a steak. And the game ended, and they won, and we had great seats right down at front. And Shai, like, basically picked me up, put his arm around me, and he goes, so here's the thing. Chicago riots when we win. We really need to get out of the stadium.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Shai's a big guy, and he basically picked me up and threw me over his shoulder and was like, Messner, follow us. And we were in a car on our way out of the stadium. By the time we got back to where we lived in Wicker Park, there were just, like, people on the streets.
Yeah.
Okay, before we get to our fan stuff, there is a story that we touched on that I feel like I need to explain. And I think this was actually from the old head. But in our watch party, when they were picking up Marilyn and Marilyn died, I was like, it's surprisingly hard to kill a cat. Because my husband had to kill
on television,
one
or you mean in real life? Oh gosh, here we go.
IRL. And it occurred to me, I should probably give a little context to that story. Right after we got married, and I mean like less than a year, within a few months, my husband went to Cambodia because a friend of his who lives there was opening a school. And my husband is a teacher. And so his friend was like, I'm going to open this school. I'd like you to come help teach the teachers. So Josh goes to Cambodia, and it's like 2 days before he leaves, and this cat wanders into the school. Now, it's Cambodia, so the school is poles and a roof and a concrete pad, but there's no walls. Yeah. So the cat wanders into the school and starts biting kids. Bites a bunch of kids, bites my husband, runs off. Somebody later from nearby, from the village, was like, pretty sure that cat's rabid. So they call the hospital. And they say, well, here's the thing. We don't have a lot of rabies vaccine. So you, in order to have access to it, you have to prove it. Yeah, and they were like, how do you do that?
You bring that cat.
Well, you have to bring the cat's head.
Fucking hell.
So remember, my husband at this point is like,
I'm sorry
25.
To laugh. Yeah.
No, I mean, it's insane. And it gets better because Cambodia is a Buddhist country. So somebody had caught this cat in a basket.
This is awful.
But wouldn't give it to my husband because they were like, you're just going to kill the cat. And as a Buddhist, I can't condone that action.
Oh my
and
gosh.
Josh was like, okay, but also I and these like six kids
will die.
Will die of
Do you know
rabies.
That, you know that rabies kills you, like if you don't treat it. It actually
100%.
Kills you.
Every time.
It's fatal.
And it's a bad death. It's a bad death.
Really? It's like you go crazy and you're foaming at the mouth and shit?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh
and
my
you
God.
Get this
kill
hydrophobia
that cat.
Where like...
Kill that cat.
So Josh basically gets a couple of people, a couple of, you know, adults who have this conversation.
Wait, hold on. When you said gets a couple of people, I'm picturing pitchforks and torches now.
So they get the cat.
A mob, if you will.
Josh has to kill the cat. And he trying to kill this cat was shockingly hard and an absolute catastrophe.
Oh, that's awful.
And may or may not have involved a machete. And then he had to take it to Phnom Penh, where the hospital was, and Phnom Penh is like 2 hours on a moped.
Oh,
so there's my husband, knowing that he's been bitten by a rabid cat, with the cat's head in a basket
in
on
a
the
basket
back of his
on
moped.
His, Oh my goodness.
Just like,
and then
finally.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
They get there and it's like, here's the cat's head. And they're like, yeah, that cat's fine.
They're like, it's 100% a rabid cat. So they treat all the kids. But the rabies thing is interesting because you get a shot, at least back in whatever, 2002, you get a shot and then you need another shot 6 weeks later. And then you need another one a few months later. And so Josh gets the first shot, gets back to Brooklyn where we're living. We go to the doctor and the doctor goes, and I was shooting on location. Oh, no. He was like, so take this shot with you and give Josh his next shot on the precise time. And he gives me instructions and he goes, by the way, just so you understand, if you do it wrong, because he was bitten in the foot and rabies is a disease that travels really slowly through fat cells in the body.
He loses his foot or something.
No, it could still kill him, but it might take 6 years. Honestly, it wasn't until like 6 years after this.
You're like, that you're still doing okay?
Oh, thank God.
Oh, my God. This is awful. This story is awful.
Well, I mean, the good news is that Josh and the kids are all alive. And the cat was going to die anyway because rabies is fatal.
Yeah, rabies will kill you. Yeah.
Rabies will kill you.
Oh, anyway, that is really quite upsetting.
Folks, don't get bitten by a rabid animal. Should we wrap it up on that? No?
Sure.
Okay, I want to wrap us up with a little bit of a different fan finale. We're going to do that when we come back. We'll see y'all in a minute.
Come on back.
All right, welcome back, fishes. I'm going to figure out how to pluralize that any day now. So here's, in our last episode, we talked with the great Jocelyn Gilsig, and we were joking about creating a series called The Perks.
Oh, boy.
How sometimes Jocelyn and I feel like being a woman in Hollywood back in those days. You were just one of the perks that the male executives and men in power got to enjoy. Now, you don't have to take that premise. We're just going to talk about the title. The title is The Perks. It's starring Sarah Wayne Callies and Jocelyn Gilsig. And the male lead of the show is Paul Edelstein. Send us
oh my goodness.
We can't do this without you. This is called Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul. I'm not leaving you behind.
Pitch.
Send us your pitches, fishes.
Pitches.
Send us your pitches, bitches. We say that with love.
Yeah.
And so you can send them into us on our Instagram at Prison Break Podcast. We want to hear your pitches for The Perks. It can be a riff on Central Perk from Friends if you want to go soft. It can be a hard-hitting documentary if you, you know, this is all avenues are open. And now, Paul, I get to ask you questions that usually we ask our guests. So as we wrap up, if you were on death row, okay, first of all, I want to know what you did to get there. What have you done to get to death row?
Oof. Capital murder, I suppose.
Okay.
Hopefully, I was going to say the name of something noble. I don't know. It's pretty awful. It's pretty awful to contemplate. Okay, go on.
Okay, we'll skip it.
No, it's
what's
okay.
What's your last meal?
Oh, wow.
I wish you guys could see his face right now. He's face down, grabbing his own hair.
It's either
tortured.
It's either like, you know, a steak, potatoes, like peas, and a beer, like some kind of like big hearty thing.
Make sure
thing.
You get your greens.
Yeah, you got your greens. Or it's like a peanut butter and jelly, and like potato chips. Or like Fritos or something like super comfort food.
Amazing.
Yeah, really depressing.
Sorry, it wasn't meant to be depressing. But
No, I know. Everybody, it's so interesting. Everybody we ask that is like, oof, depressing. And I was like, just answer the question. And then I'm like, oh yeah, that is kind of weird to contemplate.
It is, huh? Well, see, this is why it's useful for us to do this with each other.
Yes.
So the next thing that we wrap this up with is me saying, all right, I'll fill in the blank. Don't get sent to prison. But if you do get sent to prison,
establish dominance immediately.
I love it. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. That's it for our show, you guys. Come join us for our rewatch party and our next episode for Sleight of Hand, getting right towards the middle of season one of Prison Break.
Take good care of each other, y'all. We'll see you next time. Bye. Bye-bye. Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul is a Caliber Studio production. Your hosts have been friends, but not besties, Sarah Wayne Callies and Paul Edelstein. Our prison warden has been producer Ben Haber. Our head of Jailhouse Rock is Paul Edelstein, who made the music for this podcast. Keeping us slim and trim the prison yard has been sound designer and editor, the great Jeff Schmidt. Keeping us up to date on the outside world is production assistant Drew Austin. Our prison artist, logo, and brand designer is John Nunziato and Little Big Brands. Check them out at www.littlebigbrands.com. Follow us on Instagram at Prison Break Podcast. Email us at prisonbreaking@caliber-studio.com. And call us at 401-3-PBREAK. Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul has been a Caliber Studio production. Thank you for listening.